Good morning. Let the record show that the Community Regional Affairs Committee was convened at 8:10 a.m. Today we have present with us Representative Bob Herron, Representative Sam Keeter III, Co-Chair Representative Gabrielle Ladue, and myself, Representative Benjamin Noel. Sorry, I've had very little sleep. And I also would like to recognize the staff today: Chris, the House Recording Secretary; Kathleen, our LIO moderator. Oh, there she is. And our CRA committee aides, Kimberly Clark and Lisa Vaught. Please turn off your cell phones so you won't be disturbed by the ringing of that phone. So we have with us in front of us, we'll be having our second hearing and discussion on the Indian Law and Order Commission report that was published this last November. The committee previously held a hearing and discussion on the report last month, March 11. Welcome, Attorney General Geraghty, who I will ask to begin our discussion. Thank you for accepting the committee's invitation to attend. Introduce your staff for the record.
Michael Geraghty, Attorney General for the State of Alaska, and with me this morning is Corey Mills, my legislative liaison in the Civil Division, and also from Department of Public Safety, Captain Arlo, and Kelly Howell, and the Lieutenant. Lieutenant Merrill. Lieutenant Merrill, pardon me.
You may start.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me this morning. Again, I want to apologize for not attending the previous hearing scheduled for March 11 due to a longstanding scheduling conflict that I had. I did not want to delegate anybody to come in my stead, because this is a subject that I take very importantly, and I wanted to be here myself. At the outset, I want to emphasize that I've been on record since day one acknowledging the importance of the Indian Law and Order Commission report, or I may refer to it as the ILOC report. I've never shirked, and in fact, I accept the challenge expressed in the report that the state can and should be doing more to improve public safety for Alaska's Native peoples. In a moment, I want to talk about some of the initiatives the state is pursuing, but first, I would also like to respectfully express my areas of disagreement with the report. First, I believe the report gave no credit for the notable progress that the state has made in improving public safety in rural Alaska and in collaborating with the tribes and trying to find solutions to improve public safety. I'll discuss that in more detail. I also fundamentally disagree with the conclusion that ANSCA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, is a failed model. In fact, the only place I have ever read that assertion is in the ILOC report. Alaska Natives were deeply involved in the negotiated and settlement set forth in ANSCA. It was not imposed on anyone. Today, the regional corporations and village corporations created by ANSCA are among the state's most successful businesses, employing many thousands of Alaska and many thousand shareholders, both in the villages and interurban areas. A steady job is important to the vitality and safety of any family. Granted, it may not be directly tied to safety in the villages, but it is hard to overstate the contribution of the regional and village corporations to the advancement of their rural and urban shareholders, not to mention the state of Alaska as a whole. So I do not accept that ANSCA is a failed model or that we should turn back the clock. Nor do I think Indian Country is the answer to Alaska's problems. In my opinion, my respectful opinion, the Commission views Alaska's villages through the lens of the Lower 48 Reservation System, where people understand that entering a reservation will subject them to tribal law, and non-tribal member residency in the reservation is often controlled by the tribe. In contrast, since ANSCA's passage, Alaskans have been free to reside in any Alaskan community, and they expect to be governed by a uniform system of criminal laws. Non-tribal members have bought land and built lives in these communities. The commission's report, in my view, does not address the difficulties for non-tribal members living in communities that will either be split between Indian country and non-Indian lands or enveloped into Indian country. It's a fact that most of Alaska's natives do not live in rural villages. About 60% live in urban areas or hub communities and have access to all the criminal justice services that the commission found lacking in our rural communities. Law enforcement, shelters, court facilities, treatment facilities, and protected borders. How would creating more Indian country in remote Alaska villages assist them? This is not to suggest that there are not serious issues facing natives in these urban and hub communities, such as domestic violence and sexual assault. But I am suggesting that the problem, in my opinion, is much more nuanced, and it is an oversimplification to suggest that forming reservations where tribes can exert exclusive jurisdiction is a solution to the public safety problems that afflict Alaska's Native peoples. But these criticisms aside, I want to return to the theme I mentioned at the outset. My differences with the report should not obscure the fundamental point that I think the commission was urging, that there is more we can and should be doing with tribes and in tribal courts in particular to make these communities safer. I don't quarrel with that point one iota, and as I said, I don't want my differences with the report to obscure that. In point of fact, before the report was issued, the governor asked the Department of Law to draft an agreement whereby the state could delegate authority to tribal courts to deal with certain misdemeanor offenses that may occur in their communities. Under the proposed agreement, the tribal court will provide civil-based remedies for state law criminal offenses, including domestic violence and alcohol offenses. Members or non-members would be subject to these remedies, provided that they have agreed to be diverted to this tribal remedy in lieu of state criminal prosecution. It is important to keep in mind that everyone is a citizen of the state of Alaska, tribal member or not, and regardless of where they lived, and they are guaranteed certain rights under our state constitution. However, if a person commits a covered offense in these communities, I hope they will conclude that facing a civil tribal court remedy would be far preferable to prosecution in state court and a possible conviction on their record. The hope is that a culturally relevant remedy will be more effective for a first-time domestic violence offender, for example, to help them get back on track by seeing the impact their actions have had on their family and within the local community. The state is now in active negotiations with several tribes and hopes to finalize the agreement shortly. We reached out to the Tanana Chiefs Conference in December with the draft, and we've had several meetings, discussed changes back and forth, and I believe we are prepared now to reach out to tribes within TCC to finalize and sign agreements. We've also reached out to CAIC and Sitka, and I hope to make progress with their representatives as well. This limited delegation agreement, or LDA as we refer to it, I hope sends a strong signal to tribes that the state views collaboration with tribal courts as an important resource in the fight to improve public safety. The ILOC report specifically encourages intergovernmental public safety agreements such as these. One obstacle to more tribes entering into these types of agreements is the lack of federal funding for tribes to operate. In December of last year, the chairman of the Indian Law and Order Commission, Troy Ide, sent me a courtesy copy of a review he'd written about a book dealing with Alaska Natives and American laws. I responded on the 16th of December as follows, and I quote, "Thanks, Troy. I will read this with interest. I also want to follow up on our meeting and your gracious offer of help to assist the state in achieving the goals outlined in the commission's report. Alaska's tribes desperately need funding for their tribal courts. In the course of the Department of Law's discussions with Tanana Chiefs Conference about the delegation agreement, TCC raised the issue that the BIA does not currently give grants for the region's tribes to operate the tribal courts or tribal police force. That funding is essential for tribes to expand successfully their public safety function in Alaska. It would be incredibly helpful to the state and to Alaska's tribes if you and or the commission could become an advocate for Congress to provide that funding. Your advocacy on that issue would be in line with the report's recommendations for increased funding for tribal justice systems," end quote. So that is what I sent to the chairman back in December, requesting his help with this funding issue. In February this year, I was in Washington for the annual meeting of the National Association of Attorneys General, and I met with the members of our delegation to advocate, among other things, increased funding for our tribal courts. And I'll say that this is a nonpartisan issue, in my view. That message was warmly received by all members of the delegation that I visited with. So it's a nonpartisan issue. There's no question about that. But this lack of funding was a problem commented on several times in the ILOC report, namely the lack of federal support for these tribal justice programs. The Department of Law has also reached out to tribes interested in the LDA and offered assistance in completing the complicated federal Consolidated Tribal Assistance Program grant process, which is a possible source of funding for tribal courts. It is our hope that if tribal courts will sign an LDA and look at it, they can take that agreement and use that as part of the grant process to show how they're trying to expand and the vacuum that needs to be filled and to provide more justification for the grant request. But it is complicated, and we've reached out and offered to help drive you the narrative portion, or you know, we can't fill it out, but we can certainly help with narrative portions of the grant to try to assist them. What else are we working on with the tribes? Well, we're also pursuing agreements with second-class cities in Alaska, particularly villages. And I was surprised many villages are second-class cities and registered in state government, to encourage them to prosecute alcohol possession offenses under municipal law, because current state law already provides these villages the opportunity to create a panel of local citizens, including elders, for example, who can impose culturally relevant remedies in lieu of typical alcohol possession fines. In November of last year, the DPS released proposed regulations that would allow VPSOs to carry firearms. These regulations include training and oversight requirements, and there are currently two bills before the legislature that would allow VPSOs to carry firearms. This is one of the specific recommendations that came out of the ILOC report, that VPSOs be armed because they do face, you know, dangerous situations in these villages, and we've seen that just too recently with tragic results. As this body is aware, VPSO funding has been significantly increased under this administration. VPSOs currently serve many rural communities where tribes are located. They are hired by regional corporations but paid for by the state. They also attend the police academy in Sitka, and they're supervised by the Alaska State Troopers. There are currently 121 funded positions, and I found out this morning 92 are currently filled, and so that's something I know DPS continues to work on. So while they're not all filled, this is nonetheless a significant increase in numbers over the last few years. The state has also created new trooper posts in Ammonic, Selawik, and Hooper Bay. They've also increased VPS oversight by adding three support troopers for Bethel, Fairbanks, and Kotzebue. The state's Drug Abuse Resistance Education, or DARE, program trains at state cost police officers and VPSOs across Alaska to teach a 10-week drug abuse resistance program to elementary, middle, and high school students in their communities. DARE officers, who are often VPSOs, teach children critical decision-making skills to help them make healthy decisions. 16 of the 38 communities receiving DARE training during the 2012-2013 school year were VPSO communities. As part of the DARE program, DPS and the Northwest Arctic Borough School District teamed up recently to provide safety and security assessments to all 10 village schools surrounding Kotzebue. In 2010, the Iliksavik Tribal College in Barrow contacted the troopers about the possible establishment of a public safety summer camp for their regional youth. In 2007, the troopers, U.S. Marshals Service, State Crime Lab, State Fire Service, and VPSOs developed the first Alaska Youth Academy. It was a trial program focusing on at-risk Native Alaskan young adults, ages 15 through 18, in an effort to steer them away from alcohol, drug abuse, and the domestic violence which plagues their communities. The Barrow Camp was successful, and the college invited the group of instructors back the following year. To date, the camps have grown to five statewide: Bethel, Barrow, Hooper Bay, Mount Village, and Fairbanks. This year, they will enter their fourth year of camps, and they have reached out to hundreds of young adults. a new camp in Sitka is also going to be established in June of this year. In December of last year, the Department of Health and Social Services and Tanana Chiefs Conference signed Alaska's first foster care maintenance pass-through agreement. These are these Title IV-E funds. You may have referred to that way. This agreement will allow the state to pass through funds from the federal government directly to TCC to provide maintenance funds for foster care in tribally licensed foster homes. Signing of this agreement was a culmination of a long approval and negotiation process. In conjunction with this agreement, the department adopted a regulatory exemption from state licensure requirements for tribally licensed foster homes. As you might imagine, through the Office of Children's Services, the state has also interacts a great deal with tribal organizations throughout the state. For example, the Tribal State Collaboration Group meets three times each year and has done so for the past 20 years. It is a gathering of state and tribal leaders for collaboration on systems improvement, with particular focus on efforts to improve the disparity rates seen with Alaska Native children in the child welfare system. The state also provides rural child welfare services grants to tribal grantees around the state. These grants provide funding for tribes to work in close proximity with the OCS caseworker to support case management activities such as home visits, parental support, and coaching to aid in the reunification or safety of children in placement, both Native and non-Native. The Indian Child Welfare Liaison Help Desk at OCS is staffed with employees of tribes or Native organizations who serve as invaluable resources for state social workers conducting relative searches and state child protection cases. OCS has, in fact, been recognized for its innovative approach to improving the search for ICWA preferred placements. OCS also participates in joint state-tribal training to educate staff on the history of Alaska Natives and tribal cultural practices. Tribes and OCS staff co-train a curriculum called Knowing Who You Are, or KWYA, training that is mandatory for OCS staff and is provided by certified trainers from both tribes and OCS. In conclusion, I culled the list of examples I've just stated for the record from a long list of projects in areas where the state actively collaborates with tribes in a number of different fronts. But I will return to what I said at the outset. We have a long way to go. I am not here to pat myself on the back or anyone else for that matter, or to receive any appreciation. There are serious challenges facing our Native peoples, and there are no grounds whatsoever for complacency. However, I believe with the leadership of the governor and the support of this body, we can find effective ways to make life better in these small communities. Returning to a reservation system is a step back to the past. Notwithstanding, the Indian Law and Order Commission is to be commended for focusing attention on this topic. I disagree with many of their recommendations, but not with the problem they have identified. As the Commission stated in its report, quote, "What policy adjustments the state of Alaska should make in support of greater tribal authority over criminal justice is something the state and its citizens should decide, not the Indian Law and Order Commission." I agree with that, and I pledge my commitment in trying ways to effectively solve this problem, and I commend this committee and the co-chairs for drawing attention and focus on this topic. That completes my statement. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. We have one from Representative Ledoux.
So I know we're in an era right now of trying to tighten our belts, fiscal restraint, and so forth. But I guess I was wondering if how much money the state would save if a lot of these issues were diverted to tribal courts. Let's assume that tribal courts did have the money to do domestic violence courts, and they did have the money to do DUIs. So if there would be a big savings for the state there, I guess I was thinking of the possibility of taking that money that would be saved, and instead of waiting for the feds to come through with money to run the tribal courts, etc., taking the money that we would save and putting that into a grant for the tribal courts to actually run things.
Very good question, Madam Chair, and I don't know the answer to do it, but I think that's something we want to monitor. I mean, this is a pilot project. I want to get started with these agreements and get some signed and get more signed. I mean, we don't want to reach out to other areas of the state, other organizations besides TCC and the people that we've talked to thus far. So I think that's a very legitimate point and something that we'd want to study. Let's look at that and see if there are savings, see the number of cases that are diverted from the system and will be handled by the tribal courts, try to measure, come up with some metrics for determining how much fewer resources does that demand of the state in terms of the court system and prosecutors and so on. So very legitimate point. I don't have an answer to it, but that is one of the metrics I hope that we would try to measure as we go forward with the program.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Attorney General. The letter that you wrote February 1st, 2013, 15 pages, of course, that's been well over a year. And so upon your reflection, is there anything in the February 1st, 2013 letter that you would change today?
Representative Herron, I apologize. I've not gone back to read enough. February 1st of 2013, we tried to make it factual, and I did not personally gather all the information that was in there. But in terms of the analysis of the law, the state of the law, and so on, I think we'd stand beside that. We certainly didn't try to minimize the issues, and we never have tried to minimize the issues facing these little smaller communities. That's the big issue, I think, has been with the means that the commission recommends to try to deal with and how we think we should deal with it. So stand corrected, but I apologize. I've not read it before coming here today recently.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, of course, the commission's recommendation is for the state of Alaska. It is to support tribal authority over public safety and justice locally in rural communities. But they, as you've already stated, you disagree that they say that the state of Alaska, the Department of Law, is actively resisting such efforts. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think, at least since I've been Attorney General, that we've ever actively resisted those efforts. The law is, there is no Indian country in Alaska. I mean, that's my position. I think that's what the Venati case said, with the exception of Metlakatla. The commission claims that there's this archipelago, their words, of trust land, or native allotments and so on, which are scattered hither and thither all over the state. That may be the case. I'm not sure how that would assist in trying to do what they want to do. But defending the law as it is, in my view, is not actively discouraging the tribal justice, Representative Herron. I mean, I would agree, as I said at the outset, I think there's more we can and should be doing, and I've tried to describe the major initiative that we're trying to undertake, which has not been done before to my knowledge, which is to work with tribal courts and come up with some diversion remedies. But as I said, part of the problem is we're all citizens of the state of Alaska. They have constitutional rights. What am I supposed to do? Say if you're in a village, you forfeit those rights, or we're going to subjugate those rights to the right of the tribe. There's very thorny legal issues here involved in constitutional issues. I would disagree that we've actively tried to discourage these efforts. I will say we've tried to defend our Constitution and defend the state of the law.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, in your letter, though, you say it's on page 8, that there is no double jeopardy prohibition in Alaska. And so if there is a local tribal court that takes an action against a non-member, there nothing prevents you from doing as well. So why can't we – let me step back a minute, Mr. Attorney General. You talk about the Venati case, and a lot of people talk about it has to be based on land. Shouldn't there be a consideration, and I'm not saying this lightly, but can't we have tribal law concurrent with the state of Alaska and literally have a virtual land situation. I mean, it seems that we're way in the past is you have to have a piece of property to have effective tribal court proceedings.
Well, I'd like to explore the boundaries of that, Representative Hare, and as I said, this agreement that we're trying to push forward now recognizes that the virtual area and without a fixed land base or anything like that. So I agree with that. I mean, I'd like to see what we can do. It's a pilot project, but I'm a firm believer that to the extent the local communities are engaged, that's good. So I think we should try to give them a chance and give them the resources, and the federal government should give them the resources to try to succeed in this in dealing with these issues that come up, public safety issues in their community. So I agree with that. You know, I can see where at some point it becomes where is the extent of that virtual, mm-hmm. So that could certainly create issues now, but we're a long ways from that. But I mean, there is something to be said for the land base, just for the clarity, if nothing else. But we're not waiting for that, and I'm not advocating, as I said, disagree with the conclusion that we should return to any country. So I agree with what you're saying. I want to test the boundaries of that proposition.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Attorney General, is, of course, in the Knowles administration entered into a Millennium Agreement. In 2002, the Attorney General's office issued an opinion recognizing concurrent jurisdiction between the state and the tribe on child protection proceedings. That was good. That was a good deal. But 2 years later, Attorney General Rehnquist reversed it. So just so that there is a clear understanding, is to some, the Rehnquist opinion is an opinion that's valid to the Department of Law. Shouldn't we revoke that decision and that this Attorney General clarify the status and have a current opinion that recognizes tribal jurisdiction?
Well, I'll look into that, Representative Heron. You know, as far as I know, we have been working with the tribes on child protection-related matters and so on for a number of years. Now, whether that was done pursuant to any formal revocation of the previous Rehnquist, which is really a policy decision, I mean, not a legal opinion, I don't know whether it's been formally revoked or not, but in my book, everything I've learned is that is jurisdiction that our state Supreme Court has said that they enjoy and that they have. And we've not been fighting that, as far as I know. So I can't speak to the formal status of that previous decision. But as far as I know, we've been working with tribes. This is the expansion, the 4E program, you know, expanding that to pass through, allowing tribally licensed foster homes and so on. I mean, I think we've been moving in that direction. So I'll have to check, as I said, see if there's been some kind of formal revocation. But I firmly believe that we are working and should continue working on those child protection matters. And I think it happens every day. I mean, I think there's orders that are processed by the court system, by our department, and given full faith and credit and dealt with. And so, I mean, that's not to say we can't improve on it, but and we have a ways to go. But, I mean, I'm not fighting that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, so you will consider an agreement where the VPSOs can enforce tribal laws as well as state laws to address their local justice issues and have for safer communities?
I would consider it. My first question would be what tribes have written codes, and I think that's always an issue, and many perhaps do, but I mean, I think there's 78 tribal courts that have been have geared up or have been created or formed, and I think others are looking at it. But at the outset, I think, Representative Hare, we want to start with enforcement of trying to delegate authority to deal with state criminal laws dealing with alcohol, domestic violence, public safety issues in these small communities. But that's certainly something I would take a look at, but I'm just not as conversant with the tribal laws as they exist and what they deal with it. They may overlap with state laws in many instances. I just don't know. But I think that's an area to be considered.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, so I think I've heard the comment, both in your opening statement, that you're working toward a policy of state deference to tribal authority in tribal communities?
Well, we're trying to empower tribes to deal with public safety issues in their communities. And if the offender agrees to be diverted to the civil tribal court remedy, then yes, that's the we would defer to the remedy imposed by the tribal court. And so deference, I don't know if I'll get into the semantics with you, Representative Herron, but certainly that's the whole point, is to divert those crimes covered by the LDA if the offender agrees to the tribal court for disposition.
Well,
and we're not going to second guess or evaluate or, in fact, I think the agreement spells out that we're not responsible for the remedy that the tribal court imposes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, I think that's the issue is I think that this relationship that we hope to craft so that tribal authorities that are appropriate with state law can make for safer communities. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, I guess I'm going to have to go ahead and get out the one that's really disturbing to a lot of people, is that's the Violence Against Women Act and Section 901. Why is it that way? Why are we in this situation with that federal law?
Because Alaska tribes are different than lower 48 tribes. Lower 48 tribes are based on a reservation system, the land base that we referred to earlier. And over the course of many years, the state has tried to avoid any ambiguity or any uncertainty in the law that would just lead to litigation. What VAWA says, actually, and then much of VAWA is limited to Indian country, by the way. So if we accept for the moment the premise that Indian country only exists in Metlakatla, VAWA by its own terms is limited in many respects to just Indian country. But it does say under Section 905 Tribal Protection Orders, purposes of the section, a court of an Indian tribe shall have full civil jurisdiction, issue and enforce protective orders involving any person. It goes on to exclude visitors, violators from Indian land, and to use other appropriate mechanisms in matters arising anywhere in the Indian country of the Indian tribe or within the authority of the Indian tribe. Now, that's, to me, a very ambiguous and perhaps even loaded term. I'm not sure how you determine that. But it's those types of, I mean, I think part of my job, Representative Herron, is trying to avoid ambiguities in the law that can only lead to litigation and uncertainty. And so the state sought an exemption that did not expand or retract any existing tribal court jurisdiction in Alaska. So, and tribal courts do have the authority to issue protective orders in the state, and they're enforced by DPS. I think that's another common misconception. So in any event, I've read the commission's statements about that. Again, I'd have to call it an area where I respectfully disagree with them, but I understand the point fully, and I understand the point you're making. But that's part of my job is to avoid ambiguities and uncertainties of law that can lead to litigation. And then I'll preface that or end up by saying that there will be litigation. I mean, there is litigation right now. I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing. But in order to shape the contours of where state jurisdiction starts and ends and tribal court jurisdiction starts and ends, I mean, there's going to be cases over the years, and reasonable people can agree to disagree, and that's what we have a court system for, to resolve those. So, I mean, but to allow something like that to be passed and the uncertainty that might create, I think, was motivated us to seek an exemption, a clarification, if you will.
So, Mr. Chairman, just one more question on this, and then later in the meeting I'd like to reserve two related but not directly associated with this LOIC report to the Attorney General. But staying with Section 910, but at least from some that have essentially the opposite view of your office is that Section 10 does cloud the issue and is likely to result in attempts by perpetrators to fight violations on those jurisdictional grounds. So wouldn't it be better to repeal it and not have Section 910 in Violence Against Women Act? It's sending a very loud message. Maybe it's inaccurate, but it's still a PR problem for the state of Alaska, is that Alaska women, Alaska Native women especially, don't have the same rights. I understand what you're saying, and I believe you. Don't get me wrong. I believe you. But Mr. Attorney General, but it's a very extremely sensitive issue to a lot of Alaska Native women, including my wife.
Well, Representative Aaron, I respect that, and I'll acknowledge at the outset that the rate of victimization amongst Native women is shameful and something we should be ashamed of as a state and as a Department of Law. So I hear what you're saying. I believe tribal courts can issue protective orders in their communities, and I believe the Department of Public Safety will enforce those protective orders. They'll diffuse a dangerous situation. They're not going to ask into the details of their member, non-member, anything like that. If there's a dangerous situation or an imminent threat or something like that in these communities, and the tribal courts issue the protective orders. But again, I think it's come back to some extent to the lack of funding. I'm not sure they have the resources and the ability and full-time staff or even part-time staff to do many of the things that they want to do. And I wouldn't be against giving them funding. As I said, I've advocated for that with the chairman of the commission. So I hear what you're saying. Sometimes we do things, Representative, that, to an outsider looking in seem hard to understand. And again, I'd be the first to admit that the rate of victimization is very high. And that's a separate issue and a very thorny issue. To me, goes above and beyond the protective order issue. But the state has for some time tried to clarify, because we believe ANSCA was a different model. And the commission believes it's a failed model. I don't agree with that, but the commission certainly does. But it was a different model. And so in light of that, the state, when these issues dealing with lower 40 tribes are dealt with, we've always tried to be careful to clarify that nothing is going to expand or retract what the tribes appear currently doing. So I can't speak to the PR issue. I hear what you're saying, and I certainly respect as well your point of view, Representative.
Maybe just on that point, Mr. Chairman, ANCS has been modified 35 times. Why can't we change it again so that we can make this work?
Well, it has been modified a number of times and amended a number of times, mostly to continue to protect the land holdings, to protect shareholder rights, prohibit the sale of stock to outsiders and non-shareholders, and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying that ANSCA is sacrosanct. I didn't mean to imply that, Representative Heron. I was just saying that they're talking about amending in ways to allow return to Indian country. And I do fundamentally disagree with that recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, I want to offer to take a break from asking some questions, but I will provide a bunch of questions to the committee and to the Attorney General and ask for a response in writing. But, Mr. Chairman, if there's more time in the meeting, I'd like to ask a couple more questions as well. Thank you.
Representative Cheeto III.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. Attorney General Garrity, I appreciate this discussion. I guess I see a couple of things here. There's enforcement actions that result in ending up in court. We're not talking at this point about the protection of public safety that result in those enforcement actions. We're at this point talking about courts, and one of the things I think it would be good to have on the record is at this point we do have agreements and work with tribal courts. Can you explain for the committee how the tribal courts deal with the member versus non-member, say in a case where there are members and non-members of a tribe?
Well, Representative Keeter, to the best of my ability, I can say I'm not sure that I don't know this for a fact, but I'm not aware the tribal courts distinguish that if it's somebody living in their community. And I think in child protection matters, for example, the tribe believes that jurisdiction rests with the status of the child. So if the child is a member of the tribe, the tribal courts believe, at least the one I'm familiar with, believe that they have jurisdiction. So I don't know that there's a uniform view. And certainly there's a case pending before the Alaska Supreme Court now involving the ability of the tribal court to exert jurisdiction over someone who's never lived in the community and is not a member of the tribe. And the gentleman objected to tribal court jurisdiction on that basis, and he had his parental rights terminated. And that's the Parks case, and that's currently before the Alaska Supreme Court. So that will help us, as I mentioned to Representative Herron. And there are cases pending to kind of define the parameters and the outlines, contours of where the jurisdiction will be. But at this point, I don't know that there is a uniform understanding amongst all the tribal courts. I could be wrong, but I know on child protection matters, I know at least one and perhaps many of them, if not all of them, believe that the membership of the child is what controls.
Thank you. Actually, I think that helps quite a bit. It sounds like there's an open discussion and court cases that could end up providing some more of those sideboards. So I guess one of the questions I have then, you as Attorney General are working with various tribes to empower them to support tribal law. Are those agreements that the state has with the tribal organizations supportive of state law? So are the tribal governments basically acting as an arm of state law, or do they have their own laws and ordinances that they're enforcing that the state is working with?
Well, Representative Keeter, the limited delegation agreement that I referred to earlier deals with state laws, alcohol possession, DV, and offenses like that, minor theft and so on. So those would be state laws, and the offender, if they agree, would be diverted to the tribal court for a civil-based remedy. In terms of the tribal laws, as I was stating to Representative Herron, I'm not sure what I'm not familiar enough with those to give you a categorical answer. It may be that could be another step in the process. I don't know. But I think there's issues about state officers enforcing tribal laws. The fact of the matter is that there's they don't have tribal police officers or tribal law enforcement in many, many communities. They have to rely on VPSOs, and those are creatures of state law. So in terms of state officials enforcing tribal laws, I think that's problematic. But again, right now we're trying to start from a base of state laws that affect public safety in these communities and allowing tribes to take control of those offenses for an appropriate civil-based remedy and keeping the people, and again, avoiding criminal record, conviction, and so on and so forth.
One more follow-up. Thank you. And so that kind of brings me down another little path, thinking about enforcement of local jurisdiction laws. And can you explain to me how, say, a state trooper in Anchorage or in another community that has a police force and local ordinances, do they only enforce state law, or are they also authorized to enforce local ordinances?
Representative Keeter, I think certainly the troopers enforce state laws, and many municipalities with their own municipal laws have their own police force. And in terms of, I'm sure there's some overlap, and I'm sure a trooper, for example, would not stand by if a municipal law was violated, depending on what it is, and vice versa. I'm not sure a municipal officer would do the same thing. So I'm not real conversant with that. Captain Arlo is here from the public safety, and I'm sure would be much better equipped than I am to answer that. But that's would be my muddled answer at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So I've been a little bit hung up on the idea of, well, anybody can live in a community, and how do you take away the rights of somebody who may not even be in the tribe and is living in the community? And then I started to think, and I guess I'm just thinking out loud right now, but you have things like, I remember from property law, covenants that run with the land. You've got homeowners associations. You've got property owners associations. So let's say you've got a village out there somewhere that decides that they want to administer things according to tribal law. And before anybody even commits a crime, everybody agrees that as part of living out there and as part of your being able to sell your house out there, that everybody is going to be amenable to dealing with and being under the jurisdiction of a tribal court. I mean, is that all that much different? I mean, when you own a condo somewhere, I mean, just buy in the condo. I mean, you got to give up your right to, I mean, if you like red and you want to paint your house red, but believe me, if you're in a condo association and the other members of the condo association, they want muted colors, you're not going to be able to paint your house red. I mean, so how much different is that? Could something be formed through, you know, our traditional notions of property law?
Representative Ledoux, interesting notion. I think what immediately pops to mind, of course, is that we're talking about constitutional rights in the to great respect. If somebody has a right to a jury trial or has a right to counsel, I don't think you can create a covenant in a land that says the next person that buys my house is going to give those up or forego those for the tribal court.
But if the person who buys the land agrees to that, I mean, so that if you commit a crime now and you go before the court, you get your right to decide whether or not you're going to be tried by a jury or you're going to be tried by the court. All I'm saying is that, but that's after you've committed the crime and you're charged. Why couldn't this all happen before? As you're buying the land, you're signing on the dotted line that you are going to abide by the rules of this community, which means that you're not going to be tried in the courts of the state of Alaska. You're going to be tried by this tribal court.
Well, it's an interesting notion, Representative, and I think it's worth thinking about it. As I said, I think a prospective waiver, I'm not sure there's any, I mean, when you're asking somebody, I'm going to be subject to the laws of the tribe, I mean, first of all, are they written down? Is there a written code? Number two, depending on what the crime is, which hasn't been committed yet, are you giving up your right to counsel? These are, and tribal courts typically don't afford a right to counsel. I mean, they can't afford it, and that's not part of the tradition, and they don't have to. Under state law, they have to give a jury trial. That's, again, a Western tradition. So I think there's issues about that that are potentially serious issues, and so I would be cautious about it. Let me also say I think there's many people who live in these communities who probably wouldn't have an issue with being diverted to tribal court. They're probably people that they know, their neighbors, and so on and so forth, and they wouldn't have an issue with it. I'm not suggesting that there's some kind of draconian instrument out there that we all have to be concerned about. I'm not suggesting that at all, and in many instances, many people might be very content to allow that to happen. But But again, we are dealing with constitutional rights. I just think we have to proceed carefully and cautiously. But I hear what you're saying. I haven't, frankly, thought about that particular idea, but I do see some issues with it.
Well, I guess I'm following, thinking about, like, what about a gated community? I mean, in a gated community, you kind of lose your right to have people visiting you, or the right of free association, because maybe there's a guard at the gated community, and maybe your friends look kind of grubby, and maybe the guard doesn't let your friends in. Mm. But I mean, when you bought that house in that gated community, I mean, you've agreed to that.
Well, yes, you have. And as I said, an interesting notion, and one that's worth thinking about. I think people, that have lived in these communities, non-members, non-natives, whatever the case may be, for many years, built homes, their families there. They may prefer the protection of state law. I don't know, but I just think we have to be cautious about those rights. And then the issue by creating a covenant that somebody coming along after the fact could be tied into that body of laws through that method, I don't know. I'd be cautious about it, but I frankly haven't given any thought until you brought it up this morning, Representative.
And then just one more question, which is kind of following up there. So if Metlakatla it's the only tribe, isn't there a village near Anchorage that you need permission to go to, like it's around
Tyonek?
Yes.
I don't believe so. I think there's been representative incidents in the past and conflicts that have come up, but I'm not aware of that today. And Metlakatla is not the only tribe. It's the only reservation. There's 229 federally recognized tribes.
I've misspoken, but it's the only reservation.
But I don't believe that there's issues like that today. I could be wrong. I think there have been incidents in the past, but I don't know that those practices are continuing. So,
thank you.
We're going to start the testimony. We have Troy Ide from Denver, Colorado, who is willing to testify. And please state your name and who you're affiliated with. Mr. Ide?
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. It's always good to talk with you, and I appreciate your time. I won't say too much because you were gracious and listened to me not that long ago at the first hearing. I just have two very general points to make. Number one, I appreciate the Attorney General's remarks, and as I've said on many other occasions, I appreciate his public service and his energy and his responsiveness to the Commission's inquiry. None of that is in doubt. I also, though, secondly, want to clarify two things that he said that I think would deserve a little bit more explanation. And while I touched on them previously, I think it's important to clarify that for you now in this setting. Number one, what the Commission has said and what I've said also directly to the Tanana Chiefs Conference and other fora in Alaska since the report was released is that the administration really ought to clarify matters by recognizing in a clear way the government-to-government relationship between the state of Alaska on the one hand and Alaska Native Nations on the other. That relationship is very much a part of federal law. It does not turn on land status and the definition of Indian country or Indian reservations, as I'll talk about in a second. And so it just needs to be clarified. Every other state in the country has done it. Every other governor in the country with an Indian nation touching or inside of a state boundary has done it. So I don't think it's much to ask, but it would definitely provide a lot of clarity, I think, in terms of how this dialogue unfolds so that it is a productive dialogue for all concerned. And so establish that and clarify that government-to-government relationship between Alaska Native Nations and the state of Alaska, and a lot of good things will flow from that. The second thing is I really want to take exception, as I've done before, to this mischaracterization of the report on creating an Indian country in Alaska and specifically creating a reservation system in Alaska. We could not be more clear about that issue, and no matter how long it takes, we will say the same thing as we've always said, which is the commission believes strongly that there should be local control and accountability for tribal nations in Alaska to be able to keep order, to make their own laws and be governed by them. We think that the federal law requires it, and we think it's very clear that that does not turn on whether they have a certain amount of land or not. That's just a misnomer. It's not true legally, and it's not true within the framework of either Public Law 280 or ANCSA. What we've said is that the state could do this in a lot of different ways, and it's really up to the General Assembly and all of you to think about how best to make that work for all the people of Alaska. Just as the states can draw borough lines and boundaries or municipalities and make political lines effective so that there can be self-government and accountability within those borders, you could do the same thing in Alaska. In fact, you do it all the time. And you can definitely do that with Alaska Native Nations. If you have a government-to-government dialogue between the Native Nations on the one hand and the state on the other, you can determine the appropriate boundaries, and then you can make sure that you've got self-government, and you can enforce the laws that need to be enforced there and set the priorities at the local level. It'll be cheaper for the state. It'll be more responsible and responsive to everybody, but it does not turn on having to decide who owns the land. And I know that's a sensitive issue in Alaska. I respect that. I know we can litigate that for many, many years, but that is not a prerequisite, and the commission has stressed that point at every opportunity. The legislature can clarify that right now, and the way to do that would be to start having a dialogue with the Native Nations, figure out which boundaries make sense, and then make sure that there is a strong commitment to working together, and I do appreciate what the Attorney General said about this, in a partnership to try to have intergovernmental cooperation between the state and those specific nations. In some cases, they're really small, and they might want to band together and try to organize together. Some might not want to do anything right now and might want to just rely solely on the state. It might be their choice. But others certainly want to self-govern and are self-governing in many, many ways. And so have that unfold on an individual basis. Clarify the boundaries, which can be done in that dialogue. You don't have to create an Indian reservation system or talk about how different the lower 48 is to get to anything like that. We're just talking about the American value of local self-government and the legislature's right to draw boundaries in the state of Alaska, in this case, sitting down at the table with Alaska Native Nations to make sure the boundaries work for everybody. So I'm going to just stop there. I appreciate the chance to talk with you. I'm happy to take questions. And again, I do appreciate the state's focus, and I want to thank the Department of Public Safety also for the hard work that they do and that the troopers do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hyde. I have a question from Representative Keeter III.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hyde. Yeah. And I guess one of the things I'm thinking is just thinking out loud a little bit. Right now, the state does have a structure in place to allow for local governments, so we do have the ability to actually have multiple city governments. But one thing in my mind that I maybe want to get a little clarification from you, if you could help me, we have a state government that is overarching in Alaska that has political subdivisions. So the cities are subdivisions of the state, which means that the cities cannot pass laws that are different. They have to be in compliance with state law. And that way the state has the ability to make sure that the people that are in those political subdivisions are being governed by laws that are consistent with what the state legislature has passed. With the, I guess, 229 tribes, it's possible that there's a state-to-tribal relationship with one or two or possibly many, many more. But those tribes are not political subdivisions of the state, which means their laws would not necessarily have to be based on state laws. So, Mr. Ide, can you let me know if your recommendation would be that the tribal governments would work within the state framework, or if you're saying that the tribal governments should have their own laws independent of the state and that the state would then have to negotiate how those laws apply to members and non-members for each one of those tribes?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Keeter. I appreciate very much the question. It's a very thoughtful question, and it's certainly a complex question, but at the risk of oversimplification, let me just say it's the latter part of what you just said. You've got 229 Alaska Native Nations. They are federally recognized. The fact that they don't have trust lands, apart from allotments, perhaps in many instances, does not mean they lost their status under federal law. They still are Alaskan Native Nations, and they have federal recognition. So what I'm saying is that there needs to be a government-to-government recognition between the state of Alaska and each of those Alaska Native Nations. Now, there are 229 of them. I understand it's a big job. California has 100, so that's the state with the next most number of Alaska, or I'm sorry, of Native American nations in their boundaries. So 229 is a unique situation. I respect that that's different than the rest of the United States. So it takes a while to do this, obviously. But I think that when you begin the government-to-government recognition, so that there's no question that the state is recognizing them, not as political subdivisions or attempts to make them political subdivisions, but actually as Alaska Native Nations with federal recognition and federal status. Once that government-to-government relationship is clarified, which can be done literally by an executive order on the part of the state of Alaska, does not require, I don't think that requires legislation, but even if the Attorney General disagrees, it can be done certainly by the state of Alaska and with the General Assembly as well. Once that is done, then I think what will happen is a lot of the Alaska Native Nations in Alaska will begin to work together in many different ways through organizations like AFN, through Tana Chiefs, through many other organizations, that they can begin to think of the best way to work with the state so that it is not an unwieldy, complicated process, so that there is a way for each one of these Native Nations to be heard in that dialogue. I think a lot of them will want to work together regionally. Some of them will want to band together, and some of them, you know, will be at different stages in terms of how they can implement systems. So realistically, when you give people the ability to choose and you treat them fairly and equally at the table, I think that you're going to see a lot of them decide to work together, and they'll team up, and so it will not be such a massive job that it becomes impossible to imagine dealing with 229 federally recognized Alaska Native Nations. I hope that helps answer the question, sir.
It's getting close. I guess a follow-up would be, so if the state is recognizing the tribes, I guess I'm trying to think of this in terms of laws for each as individual sovereigns to recognize.
Yes.
It would seem to me that it might be important for the organizations of the tribes to actually have some kind of written structure for laws that the state could recognize and work with, rather than just saying, we recognize you as a tribe, but not knowing what kind of legal structure that tribe might have. So I don't know if that's really a question or a comment, but if you have anything you can say about that, that would be helpful.
I think that's a good comment to make, and my response to it is you should still let the Native Nations choose because, you know, again, they have federal status. They have that right. It's not, that actually is not optional. They are recognized under federal law. The fact that they lost the land base did not take away their authority as sovereigns in the United States. But having said that, it is true that some Alaska Native Nations have very developed legal systems and some don't. And so, you know, let's just be honest about that, put that on the table. And what you're going to see, I think, is that those Native Nations that sit down with the state and say, hey, you know, we'd like to be able to enforce, say, some laws involving alcohol, involving domestic violence protection, we should be able to do that. Some will want to do more than others. Some may not want to do anything for a while. They may want to wait. They may not be ready. But it should be their choice. The whole point is it should be their choice. And I find that people at the local level act responsibly. And Attorney General Garrity is absolutely right about the need to protect people's constitutional rights. And of course, the Commission's report is very clear about that, too. It may well be that the best way to do this in some cases is that, you know, when the state expresses its concern, well, what do we do about the rights of non-natives who are there? Maybe there'll be cross-deputation. There'll be other ways of being able to say, look, well, we're going to make sure that non-native, where we're not clear, that we're going to apply, you know, if the criminal law is not clear, we'll apply Alaska law to that person and we'll deal with it that way. But the bottom line is that these issues need to be addressed on a government-to-government basis between the Alaska Native Nations on the one hand, the state with the other. And I think people will act responsibly. What happens now is that the recognition is unclear, which is ridiculous because, of course, it has been clear at other moments in time in Alaska's own history, including recent history, as was mentioned with the Millennium Agreement. It creates enormous confusion, and it creates a lot of hardship in federal law in areas like the Violence Against Women Act, where, you know, I strongly disagree that any exemption of Alaska was necessary. There was no reason to exempt it. And our report called, you know, that exemption unconscionable. Again, you don't have to have land status in order to enforce local laws. And all we were saying was that if a tribal court has a process for issuing restraining orders, that those should be enforced and respected and the rights of those women protected. And however that's worked out, it ought to be done on a government-to-government basis.
Thank you, Mr. Ayed. We have here Aurora Lear. Would you come up, please? Okay. State your name and affiliation.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Judge David Avraham Volek, and I serve on the bench for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska here in Juneau. I'm a judge for the Sitka Tribe of Alaska over the pond, and I also serve as presiding judge for the St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs. I want to thank everyone for giving me a minute to say hi. I would also like to say hi to my friend and colleague, Mr. Ide, Chairman Ide. Still on the phone?
Yes, I am.
All right, good. It's good to hear your voice. I wanted to share with you just a couple of thoughts that I jotted down last night and also listening to what you were discussing this morning. First, I wanted to explain to you the possibility for what we like to call in the business the win-win-win situation. The tribes that I've worked for have been, they're on, I guess, maybe on the continuum. More developed, have full written codes, all the nine yards that folks like to see. We've been successful receiving some Department of Justice funds. And thankfully, between the three tribes that I've worked for, we've brought in about, I want to say, $1.5 million federal dollars into the state to provide tribal justice for Native people and rural communities. One of the things we did here in Juneau was secure a grant to build a family safety court. And it is true that Attorney General Garrity stated that when you're Native and you live in an urban area, you have all the access to the services, justice services, court system that any other citizen in Alaska has. But we know that the systems in place built by the Anglo-American legal system are foreign to a lot of the cultural life ways of the Native people that were here first. Particularly in the area of domestic violence or sexual assault, we're talking about deeply sensitive issues, incredibly embarrassing issues, horribly scary issues. And entering into a legal system where the judge is placed up on a pedestal in a very large courtroom and there's rules of evidence and, you know, keep the hearsay out, ma'am, you know, and I've been to some of these hearings where I've seen Native women chewed up and spit out. There's no other way to put it. And so by having a culturally appropriate venue and a forum, it increases the likelihood that they will reach out for help. My interest as a tribal judge has never been to foreclose the opportunity of the state courthouse, but to create another door, another courthouse door. And for Native families in crisis, and none of us here can dispute the statistics, we have a human crisis on our hands in this state. And we need a paradigm shift, a sea change, if you will. Putting Band-Aids And all due respect, I do love these gentlemen who are your public safety officers here. I've had the chance to travel with them to rural areas, and you have fine men and women in your justice system. But to add a few more or to put a Band-Aid over here or a little salve over here is not what we need. We have a crisis on our hands. So to add another opportunity, another forum for Native people is essential. One of the things I wanted to say, and by the way, we were successful. We've built our family safety court, and we hear domestic violence protection orders. And your attorney general is exactly right. To this point, thank goodness, we take our orders down to the courthouse. They're registered. They get stamped with a state court number. And your state police, your municipal police, deliver these protective orders. To date, as my grandmother would say, poo, 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 we haven't been challenged, and they've worked out really well. And I can tell you that the women are grateful to be able to come to a more user-friendly forum to handle these very sensitive issues. But I must respectfully disagree with the Attorney General that Section 910 of the VAWA is a clarifying measure. I don't find it to be that at all. If anything, I find it to be a cloud that creates ambiguity when the very purpose of the VAWA amendments was to get rid of that ambiguity. One of the sections that was exempted for Alaska Native women and families was that a tribal court could issue a civil protective order on anyone. That's all the verbiage that it says. It doesn't mean it matter if you're Chinese, Japanese, French, Italian, if you are beating on a tribal citizen, you can be asked by the tribal court to stay away. Alaska Native women are the only class of women in this entire United States that were singled out for disparate and unequal treatment in this law. And I don't buy that it was to clarify. If anything, it made things worse and more confusing. Why I want to tell you this is important, members of this committee, honorable members of this committee, is when it comes to domestic violence, we cannot afford to lose 1 minute. It can mean the difference between life and death. And I'm not trying to be dramatic. We know this is true. If I have a Native woman who comes to my court and says, "Help, Judge Volek, I want to get a protective order," and her batterer is non-Native or a non-member right now, I have to think long and hard about sending her away and saying, if you want something that's airtight, if you want something that's guaranteed full faith and credit and not a moment's worry, with the new law, I'm not sure I can give you that. And that is disturbing to me as a judge and as a lover of people. And I think that should be disconcerting to anybody in this room that cares about our families, Alaska families. I do work on some diversion courts. I'm excited about the Attorney General's work in this matter. Early intervention, keeping your youth out of the justice system and off of court view, should be a goal of this committee. Having that blotch, I've had young people come to my diversion court in Sitka who wanted to join the Marines. They cannot if they have a minor consuming on their record. And when they got the second chance, they were literally in tears with gratefulness. I won't go into a great deal of detail, but also our diversion courts have the time to spend with youth to find out who they are. What lights them on fire? Where are their interests? How do we turn this minor consuming into a life-changing educational event versus a slap on the hand, a fine, and a blemish on court view? These are the kinds of things that tribal courts can bring you with success. I do want to respectfully disagree with your Attorney General on another point. There was a statement that since he's taken over the administration, that they have not actively been discouraging tribal courts, and that the opposition has been mostly focused in on land-based claims, this whole Indian country boogeyman in the closet, you know, turning ANCSA backwards. However, one of the courts I work for issues something as controversial as child support orders for children in need. So we're not locking up white people. I don't have an electric chair. I'm not doing anything that's frightening. I'm not taxing. I'm not zoning. It has nothing to do with land and everything to do with Native children. And our court system in this beloved state couldn't have spoken any clearer that tribal courts have inherent retained sovereignty over their families. And it has nothing to do with reservations or whether you're in a shopping mall or what line of the boundary you're on. It has to do with the welfare of your children. And your state is battling us tooth and nail. And we are now in the Supreme Court fighting over whether it's kosher for me to issue a child support order for a tribal child. This, ladies and gentlemen of this committee, I posit, is a grave waste of your resources. And it is a grave waste to the very generation that we're all sworn to try to raise up, because we don't want them in your criminal justice system. We don't want them in your OCS system. And the statistics are clear. That's why child support's a national mandate. Children who are provided for have a bigger shot of not ending up on the demographical nightmare that we're trying to battle. So I really scratch my head at night, not understanding at all why we are encountering opposition from the Department of Law about whether we have the authority to issue child support orders. As the ILOC report said, it's got to stop. You're fighting your own citizens, but the worst part about it is you're shooting yourself in the foot, because tribes are bringing resources and ability to deal with these local issues of concern in ways that are fundamentally different and shown to be effective. Western legal systems are now turning to Native American traditional justice practices to improve our clogged dockets and the dissatisfaction that folks have in the Anglo-American legal system. Tribal courts bring this to you, and they don't, as Chairman Ide said, worrying about a problem that hasn't reared is also a waste of time. In all the tribal courts that I've traveled around the state and participated in, we go out of our way to be fair. We have no interest in denying people due process or fairness. I think there was a question, what do tribal courts do when a non-member is brought before the court? In our courts, I invite them in as a welcome guest. I give them my solemn oath to always treat them with the utmost fairness. And if ever they feel that our court is being unfair to them, I give them invitation to raise their hand and say, whoa, judge, what's this about? And 99% of the non-members have decided to stay of their own volition, because tribal court's a lot faster and easier to deal with, and we haven't had a problem. I had one guy who tried to play a game with me. He was trying to get out of child support. So I said, okay, go to the state. Enjoy those interest rates. So, but everybody else knows that these courts are to be trusted and they're helpful. We're problem-solving courts. So with that, I do think it would be helpful if the Rehnquist, that was a Freudian slip, sir. Rehnquist's opinion would be removed. You know, in my own personal life, I monitor the Middle East peace situation a lot, and the Palestinians and the Israelis and da-da-da-da. What's going to be with all this? But one of the things that always sticks in my craw is the Palestinian charter still calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. So we'd like to negotiate and get along, but geez, that's an awful thing to have in paper. And so the Rehnquist opinion, as far as I can tell, is still the official opinion of the Department of Law. Okay, maybe we're making some progress over here and progress over there, but why is it still there? Because the Supreme Court said it was flat out wrong. So I think it would be helpful for this sea change, this paradigm shift, that you remove the old vestiges of the Indian wars that are being waged in your courts, and we try to welcome in some real change. It's warm. The fact that you guys are having this hearing is so, what's the word? I can't find the word now, Representative Herron. It's, unfortunately, Troy can't see, but I'm giving you my smile. I'm not sure this kind of hearing would have happened a few years ago. The fact that we're having this conversation is unbelievable progress. So I think the tribes would be open to joining the state as brothers in arms. I want to say that tribal courts are the third sovereign, as referred to by Justice O'Connor, and they bring you untold value. I thought your question was incredibly insightful. Do you know how many children are now not in your OCS care, not in your child welfare system, because the tribes have intervened early and have taken them into your system? Do you know how many child protection cases are not in your court dockets right now because we're handling them? What is the price of what we're saving you? And particularly if we stop this litigation party that we seem to be having, how much money are you going to be saving on lawyers? So, like you said, it would be interesting if the state could enter into intergovernmental grants with its tribes to try to do this. The other last piece I'd say is I vote that we reform the name of these agreements from limited delegation agreements to intergovernmental agreements. Even the word delegation has a flavor of paternalism, like, okay, we're going to let you do this now. Join with your sister sovereign as partners, and let's turn around what's going on in this state.
Thank you very much.
Those are my words, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
So would you see the state entering into an agreement for tribal courts as a little bit like, well, I used to live in New York, New York City, and I know that in New York City that amongst the Orthodox Jewish population there, people often at the beginning of their marriages, they entered into an agreement so that if they were going to be divorced, that the divorce would be according to Talmudic law. And the New York courts then enforce the decisions of the rabbis in the Talmudic law.
Yes, I do see a lot of similarities to that. I guess the one piece that we always have to, you know, and I love your creative thinking of ways of entering into these agreements that are palatable and make sense. And I'm with you, you know, to look for these while always not losing hold of the fact of what Chairman I said is these are nations. And so native nations are an interesting separate product of our Constitution and our early history, and their governments. So whatever agreements we're able to forge to make sure that they're government-to-government agreements. And, you know, so a lot of these interesting creative ways of getting to that are good, and I think they need to be explored, but not to lose sight of the fact that we are dealing with sovereigns. And I again have to respectfully disagree with my colleague, Attorney General Garrity. That book that Chairman Ide, the review that he sent him, was one that I was privileged to write with my mentor, Alaska Natives and American Laws. And basically, our federal government has said that Alaska Native tribes are not different than lower 48 tribes. They have all the same privileges, immunities, and authorities as any tribe. I don't care if it's the Navajo Nation, you know, the Navajo Haitian, the Hopi Nation, or if you're from Kivalina. So, yeah, our landscape's a bit different up here, but legally, a sovereign tribe is a sovereign tribe, and there's no such thing as a different Alaska tribe.
I guess I'm just wondering that, for example, some people get too hung up on the idea that you have to have land. Mm. I mean, because the important thing, as I see it, is kind of a local government that solves the problem in a culturally local sort of way. So just the same way that some people may be getting too caught up in land in order to see the forest from the trees and to solve the problem, I'm just wondering, and I hope everybody here doesn't jump on me, that maybe we're getting too hung up in the sovereign to sovereign. Maybe it's just an idea that just forget the names and everything and just try to solve the problem.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that to smarter people than myself. That's why we pay you the big bucks. But I would like to respond briefly, and that, you know, part of it is anachronism. That, you know, because it was a reservation system moving east to west with the settlement of the United States, the laws got calcified around this idea of land. And now the Alaska Supreme Court has said, no, it's more fluid than that. So I agree with you that if we get too hung up on land, we're going to get, you know, we're going to be losing the forest for the trees.
We're getting low on time, and we have another person here in the back who has signed up, Aurora.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Aurora Lair, the Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And first, I'd like to thank you all for being here this morning. What I understand is a very long night. And again, this is a continuation of our discussion from before. And I do hope that, I'd certainly appreciate Attorney General Garrity coming here and spending so much time with us, or with this committee. And being available to engage. So AFN has, and I think I may have mentioned this before, but a committee of our board is the Council for the Advancement of Alaska Natives, and that is the group of regional nonprofit organizations and statewide entities that serve Alaska Natives. And that group has established public safety in rural Alaska as a priority, and that group has also come together to put forward the recommendations that were distributed to you this morning. Luckily for me, I get to be very brief today because most of the recommendations that AFN has put forward have already been covered by one person or another this morning. I will simply kind of echo some of the points that have been brought up earlier, that the overall recommendation that we're searching for, what we're really the goal of this discussion, and hopefully that this discussion can continue beyond today, is there needs to be a real partnership with tribes and between the state and tribes, and that partnership should be based on an understanding that it is not a loss of authority for the state, but rather a gain of untapped resources. And again, you know, there's kind of a interesting history, but I think everyone in this room has agreed and said that it's time to move forward, it's time to seek creative approaches and really make a change. And also wanted to, again, remind everybody that the ILOC report is not the first commission or report to cover, you know, the very extreme conditions and, you know, what it's like to live in rural Alaska and what access to resources are out there, to justice resources, and just to a general overall public safety. So I think it would be great as we do move on in this discussion, if we take a look back and see what some of these prior commission recommendations have. You know, a lot of them are very similar to what is in the ILOC report, but, you know, I think some of them are kind of so intuitive that we tend to skip over them. So I think it would be great if we could all sit back and say, okay, what are some very basic things that we can do in the meantime while we're trying to come up with these different solutions? Again, the Millennium Agreement that was brought up by Representative Herron should be resurrected and become an active policy that is followed by state agencies. And you know, a current opinion revoking the Ranky's opinion, I think, would also be very helpful. And generally, when there's so much confusion in so many different areas, anything that this body can do or that the Attorney General can do to clarify kind of the state of affairs, where we are at, I think would be extremely helpful, especially moving forward. Again, AFN is, you know, very supportive of intergovernmental and cross-jurisdictional agreements between tribes and the state. I think that is a fantastic goal to have. You know, certainly appreciate the work that the state has done in coming up with an agreement with the Tanana Chiefs Conference. And we hope that that is, you know, the first of many intergovernmental agreements that can be made. Again, this was distributed to you earlier. I don't want to read through everything, but just to, you know, there are some kind of smaller areas where clarification can be made, and you know, including tribal governments in paternity and vital statistics statutes, you know, civil and criminal procedure, just kind of smaller technical fixes that can, you know, help clarify and clear the path for these different agreements. And of course, you know, repealing Section 910 of VAWA is something that we've been very vocally supportive of, and we're very hopeful that it, you know, Senators Murkowski and Begich have committed to repealing Section 910. We're hopeful that if the Safe Families and Villages Act, you know, if that moves forward, that the repeal stays in there. And if not, then the repeal moves to another moving vehicle in the Congress. So, again, happy to, you know, be here and, I guess, reiterate what has been said before, and appreciate all of your time and willingness to keep this discussion going.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Would like to ask if there is anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify. Thank you. I'd like to invite the Attorney General back. We have a question for you from one of the members, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, hold on. Before we go, I'd like to close public testimony right now, and we'll go back. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, Mr. Attorney General. They're not specific to the Indian Law and Order Commission, but they're related. Since the report's come out, you wrote a letter to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs stating that tribes should not be allowed to take their lands into trust because they will lead to pollution and increase public safety problems. Why do you believe this?
Representative Herron, if you're referring to the letter that was sent on the Carcieri fix, I don't believe we said that would happen. I think we said that is one of the issues that could arise by creating this. I mean, I think the commission uses the word archipelago to refer to all these various allotments that exist in the state, several million acres, and it's a complication. We're one state. We're one state. We need to keep that in mind. We've got different referred to the 229 federally recognized tribes or governments, and I don't quarrel with that point, and we should have government-to-government relations with them. I don't quarrel with that point either. I believe we do quite frankly. I mean, I went through a whole litany of issues where we're working with tribes. I'm not sure how you do that if you don't at least implicitly, if not explicitly, recognize who they are. So the carcieri fix, again, is referring to a Supreme Court decision. I don't think we're the only state to take issue with it. A number of other states have as well for the same reasons. But I don't think we did not state, I'm pretty sure, that it would lead to those issues. But that is certainly an issue that could arise by creating this patchwork quilt of jurisdiction throughout the state where it's up to that local entity, local tribe, to deal with all the issues that come up there, and do they have the resources to do it? I'm not saying they want to despoil their land, obviously not, but issues come up. They're regulatory. They lease land to a developer, somebody else, and something happens. I mean, I it's speculation, and I did not mean to state, and I don't believe we did state, that it would lead to those issues. Could.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Attorney General, one more final question, and to let me begin with, on behalf of my constituents in the King Cove area, this is related to your 180-day notice that you intend to sue the feds on the issue of Eisenbeck and in a safety corridor to Cold Bay and using RS-2477. But my question to you is that the people of King Cove have chosen not to challenge Jewell's decision by using something that a former governor did by getting on a cat and start building the road regardless of what the federal government said. And the reason that they don't do that is they don't want to break the law, and they believe that Secretary Jewell broke the law, the Congressional Act, and ignored their trust responsibility. And, of course, it's well chronicled about that whole debate. But I guess the question to you is, did you consider challenging the Jewell decision on behalf of the residents of King Cove and the state that she violated the trust responsibility and broke the law per court decisions and the Act of 2009?
Well, that decision is subject to an active review at the moment, Representative Aaron, and all avenues are being pursued, including the ones you mentioned. I just want to clarify the 180-day notice of intent to sue does not mean we are going to sue on an RS-2477 claim, but that is one of the options that we're researching. But we can't. It's a jurisdictional requirement that we provide the notice or else we're foreclosed from the remedy. So it's just that's all we're doing is keeping our options open. But we certainly, as you well know, neither the delegation nor the administration, nor I'm sure this body agrees with the Secretary's decision, and all remedies to get that turned around are being explored, including the ones that you mentioned.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, the reason I take advantage of this opportunity to bring it up, it is because I believe that though it's related to other issues that we have with federal overreach, this one is particularly annoying because is, in my opinion, she has violated the trust responsibility to Alaska Natives. And it's just an indication of the attitude by our federal government toward Alaska Natives, but all Alaskans as well.
No, I met with the secretary in Washington in February when I was there and let her know. And it's the third year in a row I've met with the Secretary of the Interior. In all three visits, I brought up Eisenbeck, Representative Aaron. And so I expressed my disappointment on your behalf, generally speaking, as well as the people of Alaska, that we're very disappointed. And as I said, we'll see what happens. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
On the decisions made by the federal government on issues of access and egress and ingress and all that, I've always said that the federal government has, especially the departments, the secretaries and the people who work for the departments, like the I won't name them, but those departments, those agencies, they go into areas where our people, especially our Native people who own land or are in areas where the federal government has their wildernesses and their and places where you know where nothing can ever happen, and then for those areas where the where the federal government has set aside for a certain activity, those areas are then place restrictions on by the agencies. In my mind, they are usurping the power of the Congress by making areas where you can't access or you can't do the activity that was mandated by federal law. So what do we do when that happens? What is our remedy for those kind of things when our own people who own the land that have the resources can't even do anything because of the mandates by agencies, not by Congress?
Well, Mr. Chair, very good question. I share your frustration. As you know, we challenged a number of those decisions ourselves at the state. I mean, many respects, I think they're political issues. I mean, if Congress, if the agencies overstepped its bounds, Congress should act to rein them in. But unfortunately, we have a Congress, as everyone knows, it seems to be gridlocked most of the time and unable to reach a decision. But, you know, to take an example, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Lilly Ledbetter case a few years ago, and when, you know, when you had a ripe cause of action for unequal pay. And they issued a decision, they interpreted the law, and there was an outcry about that. Congress passed a law, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, to basically overrule this decision they didn't like. So Congress has the ability to create, to provide the checks and balances that you point out that they're currently missing when agencies act in a vacuum. So, and I wish they would, but I, beyond that, you know, we try to challenge those in court. But, of course, agencies get deference many times under the Chevron case for interpreting their own regulations. So it's a very difficult issue. I don't have any silver bullets for you, Mr. Chairman, but I certainly sympathize with what you're talking about, and I wish we could do more at the congressional level to rein these agencies in.
Representative Ledoux.
Attorney General, if you remember when I was talking to the tribal court judge and referring to the instances in New York City where people have agreed to abide by Talmudic law for their divorces and all sorts of other family relations things. Could you look into whether or not you believe that it could be started out in a fairly small community, that if everyone agreed to abide by tribal law initially, whether or not the courts would enforce that? Without getting into, you know, whether it's nation to nation or whether there's land, but whether you could simply do it from the very beginning, a community where people are living.
Well, Representative Ledoux, we will take a look at that. I don't know the answer here. And I just for the record, I was responding to Troy sent me a book review, and it was a case book by Case and Volokh. And I didn't, until the judge mentioned it, I didn't put the two together, but he's absolutely right. It was a horn book on Alaska Natives and American law that he was a co-author of. So I'll acknowledge that. But very good question, Representative Ledoux. I will look into it. I don't have an answer for you, but please allow us to respond in writing, if you don't mind.
I'd love that. I mean, I'm just looking at, I mean, for example, when we get on the Internet here and we use the legislative Internet, and I mean it's like in really small print and everything, where we're basically agreeing that somebody in, I guess, IT can see everything that we have written, which would otherwise be an invasion of privacy, mm-hmm. but we're agreeing in it in advance in order to use the free internet here. So, I mean, in all sorts of instances, people waive rights that they have.
Interesting concept, and I want to look into it. I know where you're. I think I know where you're going with it, and what your intent is, and it's a very interesting concept.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any final comments or discussion from committee members?
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Attorney General.
My thanks to the committee.
Thank you.
If not, we stand adjourned at